The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Good morning, everyone. Sorry to disturb conversations. Welcome to CBF Legal this morning, and a special welcome for those who might be here for the first time. We have Professor Edwin Judge back with us this morning, and Professor Judge this morning and next week as well is focusing on the Ten Commandments, and you can see the topic on the front page of the handout there. I'm just going to read very briefly Professor Judge's biography, which is on page two. You don't have to look at it, and then Professor Judge will commence his talk. So, Edwin Judge, upon receiving his honorary Doctor of Laws from Sydney University in 2006, Emeritus Professor Edwin Judge was described as one of the leading academic figures in modern Australia. He has founded numerous academic journals and research centres and has the Cicero Ethos excite, alarm and electrify his listeners and readers. He founded the Ancient History Department at Macquarie University, for which he is now Emeritus Professor. He is a historian of culture and inherited traditions. Now, for those who haven't been with us before or not for a while, our program is that Professor Judge will speak for about 20 or 25 minutes or so, and then we'll take a 1 or 2 minute break, and we'll get you to scribble out any questions you have, some paper in the middle of your tables and some pens. Professor Judge will then answer those questions, and we'll be all finished by 8:20. Professor Judge, over to you. Welcome.
It is the fault of this organisation that I am speaking to you today on the Ten Commandments. It was certainly not my choice. What happened was that about the time I was last here, some radio station rang up the Law Society and said they needed somebody to talk about the Ten Commandments because it was Easter Sunday. This question was then passed to me, I think from the Law Society, and intrigued by what the Ten Commandments had to do with Easter Sunday, I fell for it. And then the CBF asked me to come and do it here. The picture of the Ten Commandments, which is on this handout, shows it as two tablets taken, no doubt, in a church where those things used to be displayed. With regard to church use, I might just say also, by way of introduction, that I was pleased to be asked to speak on the Ten Commandments because I had an ecclesiastical vested interest in them, which you can tease me about later if you want. The Ten Commandments are shown as two tablets. And the business of two is justified, of course, by the summary which Jesus gave. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God and thy neighbour as thyself. That sets it out as two options, so that honouring one's parents belongs on the authority side of the tablet and the other five on the neighbouring side. There was written a while ago a book called The Canon of Two Virtues. And the two virtues were piety and philanthropy. This canon was nowhere stated in classical Greece, where it was supposed to have come from, but was held by its writer correctly to be implicit in much of the popular ethical discourse of classical civilization. Piety and philanthropy. And with regard to piety, that was, of course, in classical culture, not explicitly an attitude towards the divine, but an attitude towards anybody to whom you had obligations, your country, your parents, and so on. So we might translate the words into respect, to whom respect is due, and generosity towards the rest. So are these Ten Commandments an example of the classicizing canon of the two virtues? Let me say at once that they will not be virtues, because the cultivation of personal virtue was not central to the culture of ancient Israel. The virtues are those good properties which you possess and which can be practiced and developed. They are your property, as it were. But these commandments are emphatically not your property. They are handed down to you as binding instructions. It might be easy to try to explain the culture of Israel in conjunction with the Greco-Roman culture, and indeed it's the reigning framework in which these things are studied. And amongst the dominant opinions that you'll find offered in universities these days is that Moses didn't exist anyway, because we have no historic evidence for him, nor for that matter do we have any historical evidence for David and Solomon. So the whole thing is probably a legendary, even mythical retrojection from a later period in the history of Israel of how to explain their rigid customs, or whatever you regard them as. And this reigning opinion posits a 6th century BC origin for the Pentateuch and the Law of Moses. Apart from the lack of direct historical evidence for the earlier things, this is influenced by the language of the Pentateuch, which is in the classical form of Hebrew, which was established by the 6th century, the period when the captivity in Mesopotamia was coming to an end, and which it's supposed would not have been available in earlier centuries. So it is primarily a linguistic judgment that is made. If you look on the sheet, the other sheet, the textual sheet which is put on the table, the side which has the tabulation of the Sinai Covenant and its renewals. This is an extract from a book by Kenneth Kitchen, whose title you'll see in the top left-hand corner, On the Reliability of the Old Testament. This work, which came out in 2003, is a blockbusting and highly polemical refutation of the denial of a historical framework for the Pentateuch and indeed the origin of the Israelite monarchy. Kitchen himself is a specialist in the history of New Kingdom Egypt. He is indeed the world authority on the textual, the numerous textual records from New Kingdom Egypt. And it is New Kingdom Egypt, that is Egypt in the middle to late part of the second millennium BC, that is another 600 years further back in time from when, on the current account, the Pentateuch originated. It's that period from which the saga of Moses arises. And it arises, of course, in Egypt. Moses is an Egyptian name. And as you know, the Exodus took place when the children of Israel in servitude in Egypt were delivered under the leadership of Moses. And this led to the commandments of Sinai, the Ten, and all the other laws that followed that we have to deal with. So Kitchen has brought together a massive welter of historical information, not specifically about Moses, since that doesn't exist, but about the conceptual framework and the customary practice of the times in which Moses is supposed to have been functioning. And if you look at the left-hand side of that page, the one called On the Reliability of the Old Testament, you'll see that he has an analysis of the Sinai covenant and renewals. That is, in the Old Testament scriptures themselves, you get three different versions of it all. The Exodus Leviticus version, and the Deuteronomy version, from which my extract on the other side of this sheet comes, and the later Joshua version. And you'll see that he's broken up the contents of these three treatments of the law according to six headings. And the bit that's photographed on the other side of this paper, don't bother looking at it just now, is in box three in the middle column, and it's the middle line of that where it says A, basic, five. The five means chapter 5 of Deuteronomy, which is what I've photocopied. And so this is a basic stipulation according to this particular analysis. Now, where does the analysis come from? Well, it arises, you can see from the table on the other half of the page, from the whole arena of documents of treaty, law, and covenant across two millennia of ancient Near Eastern history, principally focused upon Mesopotamia. It was in Mesopotamia, of course, that the later exile of the children of Israel occurred, and from which they're supposed to have derived much of their thinking. And you'll see the down in the left-hand column of the right-hand table, six. This is a different set of sixes. That's where they've got Roman numerals. Six classes of treaty, law, or covenant, arranged in chronological order. And in the second column in the table 22, you'll see the date ranges for them. And it's number 5 in this table in the date range 1400 to 1200 that we're talking about. This is a period which is exceptionally well documented for Egypt. Shortly after the year 1400 BC, the spectacular reign of Akhenaton in Egypt occurs, for which we have precise dates, 1367 to 1350. He is the great, allegedly monotheizing pharaoh. And the equally famous Tutankhamun, the one whose gold-studded coffin was excavated, is dated shortly after that, 1347 to 39. And they are pharaohs of what is called the 18th dynasty of Egypt. And in the 19th dynasty, which follows, one has the long reign of Ramses II, which runs from 1290 to 1224. And everybody agrees that if the Exodus from Egypt is to have a historical setting, it will be in that reign, in the 19th dynasty, which began where Ramses began in the year 1290. So we're in a very highly documented epoch of history, and out of that is supposed to have come the Exodus under Moses, although the Egyptian sources say nothing about it. Now, what Kitchen is doing in this table is dealing with the structure of the Sinai covenant and the law codes that follow, and he's not inventing this. For a whole couple of generations now, since the middle of last century, the idea has gripped documentary historians that the structure for all this is that of the covenant, meaning by the covenant not a contract between two people merely, not that is a bargain of equals necessarily, but the kind of agreement that you get after a military victory, when the dominant sovereign lays down the conditions on which the defeated will function as vassals. And of course this kind of treaty, the imperial treaty if you like, lays a specific type of obligation and commitment and atmosphere upon the loyal subjects who may have been previous enemies. So we have a huge amount of documentation of this kind. I think there must be 80 or 90 extant treaties of this type in this huge epoch we're talking about. And going back to the right-hand table on the kitchen page, you'll see that in the fifth column down under details, that we have for this particular epoch, the hypothetical Moses epoch, 31 or more Hittite treaties. The Hittites were the dominant power in Central Asia Minor in this epoch. They were, interestingly, an Indo-European people, the first clear emergence of Indo-European influence, that is the linguistic family to which we belong, in this part of the world. And they contested the sovereignty over Syria and Palestine with the pharaohs in Egypt. There were major wars and great treaties, the texts of which we have both in Hittite, or rather in Akkadian, which was the international language, and in Egyptian, of the same contracts. So we know a great deal about the diplomatic and international affairs of this epoch. And you'll see in the box there the various other linguistic documents that we have. Now, Kitchen has picked up the proposition which many others have made, that this gives you the explanation of how the manifestation of the law to Israel is constructed. Now turn back to the other side where we've got the text. One of the features of this text is buried by the modern English translation, I regret to say. This photocopy is from the New International Version, and I've picked it not because it's good, but simply because its layout happened to suit what I want to say today. All the contemporary English translations destroy a key element at the heart of this document. But with a bit of, if I thought you, well, better be careful what I say about the law. But if I thought you were interested in the pedantics of this matter, as I am, I would set you the task of working out where the word you or your occurs in this text, whether the you or your is singular or plural. And the tragedy which our language has suffered in this epoch, the modern epoch, is the loss of the distinction between singular and plural in the second person pronoun. Other languages have kept it. French has kept it, German has kept it, and the ancient languages, of course, all carefully observed it. So that the pronouns, we've kept the distinction between singular and plural for the third person, and we've kept it for the first person. The distinction, that is, between I and we, and between he and they in the third person. But in the second person, we've lost the distinction between thou and you. You being plural and thou being singular. And we've made everything new out of a kind of mock courtesy. This is how these things work. That the plural comes, royal people, as you know, speak of themselves in the plural. This is a kind of courtly assumption of generality or something like that. And it becomes polite, as it is in French and German, for example, to address individuals in the plural, second person, and English recently gone down the gurgler over this matter and driven out the singular second person pronoun altogether. Now, this is not a grammar lecture. This touches the very heart of this document. You can see from the first verse of 5 that Moses is addressing Israel, the community. One might have thought, therefore, in the plural. And indeed, he is using the plural. In your hearing today, if we were writing it into distinct English, we would use the plural nominative form, ye. Well, it's an adjective, you or I know, but we would be in the ye form for that opening address. And you can see, even our washed out English, from the second verse of chapter 5, that it is the plural because it says us. So we've kept anyway, I'll stop the grammar at this point. So you have to read down and observe carefully where it switches from plural to singular. Verse 4, the Lord spoke to you face to face. It'd be nice to know, is that plural or singular? Because it wasn't everybody. Well, you can check that matter out in the other versions. And Moses then says, this is what's Moses up to here? This is 40 years after these events, remember. And he's looking back and reminding them of what they've already been through 40 years before, and which has already been treated in the books of Exodus and Leviticus. Same things. So, look to the face-to-face appearance. Remember, it began with a burning bush and then a thundering mountain and so on. And he is a singular first person. See, Lord and you, and that you must be plural, to declare to you the word of the Lord, because you were afraid of the fire and did not go up the mountain. And he said, this is the Lord. We know it's the Lord and not Moses, because skipping across two columns in verse 22, he says, this is Moses talking, these are the commandments the Lord proclaimed in a loud voice in to your whole assembly. So they did all hear it. Anyway, he said, I am the Lord thy God, singular, who brought thee out of Egypt, singular. These commandments are not addressed to Israel as a nation. They are addressed individually to everyone. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. And right on down to the end of it. Popular English, it just lingers on, doesn't it? If you want to pretend to be Moses, you say, thou shalt. They get it right. It's singular. See verse 11. You shall not misuse the name of the Lord thy God, for the Lord will not hold anyone guiltless who misuses his name. This is the singular focus. And in verse 12, the way down that long verse, the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord thy God. On it thou shalt not do any work, neither you nor your son or daughter, nor thy manservant. So the singularity for us there. Now the English really betray, the modern translation betrays us totally in 15. It says, remember that you were slaves. They had no business to use a plural there. Thou wast a slave. I don't know Hebrew, as a present, please check the Hebrew. set of instructions to the individual. They are not law. The sovereign makes the deliverer who rescues, makes on you personally of loyalty. It is a loyalty yourself. Loyalty. It's not collective, or shouldn't be. The far right column on this sheet, in chapter 6, verse 4, "Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God," plural, "the Lord is one. Love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and all thy soul and with all thy strength. These commandments that I give you today are to be upon your hearts. Impress them on your children. Talk about them when you sit at home. Tie them as symbols on your hands." So on. How extraordinary in the history of human culture is the history of Israel. To this day, 3,300 years later, it is still exactly being practiced. That is the personal commitment. And notice the entirely moral, if you like, as opposed to legalistic commitment it is. It's not just that you keep the law, it's you love the Lord your God with all your heart and strength and soul. Who can read the Psalms and not see part of Hebrew culture how they revel in the law? I wonder how many solicitors surrounded by those hefty tomes sit in a state of spiritual ecstasy day by day because they're in the presence of the law. But that's how it was for Israel. "Lord, how I love thy law," says the psalmist. "It is my meditation all the day long. It is what the Lord has said to me, and I will do it, and I love it." Is it a relic of Mesopotamia? There is nothing like this in the culture of Mesopotamia. The grand framework, the treaty structure, if you like, the loyalty commitment is part of the formal apparatus of that time, and that justifies Kenneth Kitchen's proposition that is authentic. When these things in the developed language of a later epoch. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Edward. Why don't we take a 1 or 2 minute break? If you've got some questions, scribble them out on the pieces of paper. We'll collect them and then Edward will answer.
I was supposed to say hundreds of things. Should I start straight away? I can't answer that one anyway.
This one's for me. It's a comment. I think maybe just explain what the Pentateuch is. Some people may not know.
Thank you.
And there is archaeological evidence for referring to the house of David.
It's denied. I don't know the evidence, but these things are all contested. Ladies and gentlemen, I start with the easiest question I've been asked, because I can't answer it. Is the seven-day week a relic from tidal patterns in the Persian Gulf? All I can tell you about that is that the Romans, for reasons never explained to my satisfaction, in the first century AD, gave in to the seven-day week under the impact of Jewish Sabbath observance. We know this from the Roman poets. The Romans didn't have a seven-day week, but things shook into place. And the Jewish people, of course, were a subject people to the Romans. And because of the Jewish diaspora, everybody saw and reacted to the distinctive lifestyle of the Jews. People criticized the seventh day as a day of laziness. This was the Romans' view. Jews were idle. You're not working on those days. But the pattern caught on, and that's how we got the seven-day week. So we got our seven-day week, when I say we, I mean general Anglo culture, from Judaism. Is there a spiritual quality in Mosaic covenant worthy of note while connecting linguistically with current modern language? Yes, it is a spiritual issue in my view, and I'm sorry to be so pedantic about the words, but I just wanted to really make the point that this is a matter of personal commitment. Even this is a huge legalistic structure from one point of view, and in this book after book, we're talking about the whole Pentateuch, the first five books of Moses in the Old Testament, all of which, apart from creation, of course, but they all climax in the elaboration of the covenant of Sinai, that is, the laws laid down on that occasion. And I, in my brief time and loose way, I simply wanted to make the point that national though it was, and national though its consequences are, the consequences are there to this day on a grand scale in the Middle East. The specific consequences of all this, nevertheless, the reason why they last is because of the individual commitment that is required of it, which is caught by the little grammatical point I was making. Of course, it's a spiritual issue. We do have historical archaeological reference to David in a reference to the house of David. Yes, I'm conscious of the fact that evidence keeps accumulating, and the point of view which I stated about the reigning opinion in academic circles being even that David was not historic, I don't know what argument is brought against this piece of evidence. But we are dealing with small individual pieces of evidence in a case like this. I don't doubt that David existed, and most common sense, pardon the word, impertinent word, ancient historians would take it for granted that David existed. Indeed, I take it for granted personally that in any so-called legendary tradition, you don't have a legend at all. Take the dismissal of 1975, a legendary tradition that we have. But something has to happen to cause it, and something big and important, and all kinds of things may get spun around it in a tradition. So ancient historians generally are very respectful of inherited traditions. Homer is treated with great respect for the same reason people treat the biblical historians treat the biblical documents with great respect. They are inherited documents, which will go back to something. The people who are having the problem are the specialists in this field who understandably feel a tremendous pressure to view skeptically the issue of historical evidence. Precisely, in my view, precisely because of the huge weight of consequences at the personal level that follow from this tradition. That's my guess as to why people search. I don't think it's wrong to search for counter-evidence. I'm not against that. Anyway, passing on, could I expand on the significance of whether you is singular or plural? The significance that I wanted to draw out was that though this is, in one sense, a treaty between a sovereign, God, and a nation who are being rescued by a military victory, the exodus from Egypt, or escape, and it is highly communitarian, therefore, its key document is nevertheless addressed individually to each person separately. The commitment of loyalty is personal, not just tribal. That's the point I was trying to make. Next one. We have an overt Nicene Creed. Why is there not a very directly Ten Commandments focused code? Well, yes, interesting question. I suppose that the Nicene Creed is an attempt to define the meaning of what is said about Jesus and his status as Christ and Son of God in the Gospels. What the Gospels say about him poses profound philosophical problems over the concept of God, how it's possible for a human being on earth to be a son of God, and so on and so on. And the creeds of the 4th century, of which the Nicene Creed is the key one, were really an attempt at the intellectual level to reconcile the contents of the Gospels, the ideas, with the reigning philosophical structure of thought. So it's the Nicene Creed that needs an explanation historically, and that's it in my view. I'm not sure that the Ten Commandments do need an explanation. They seem to me to be pretty plain and blunt and self-evident to everybody, actually. But still, I'm asked, do I believe God dictated the Ten Commandments to Moses on Mount Sinai? Well, I think I'll escape that by saying it's a theological question and I'm a mere historian, but I take it as a serious question. And I think before I answer it, which I'm not going to do, I would say I would need to enter into a discussion on who God is, why we believe in God, and so on. It depends really on how you construe the world as a whole, as to whether you can accept a direct communication from the divine. The next one. Even before exilic Israel, the law was not observed for hundreds of years. Why the later renewal? Well, as I understand it, what happened was that, yes, there were a considerable amount of non-observance. I mean, much of the history of Israel is written in other parts of the Old Testament. It's full of the inadequacy of the of the nation to keep up its side of the loyalty deal. But as to why the later renewal, it comes from the prophetic side. Well, there was a rediscovery of the text, but essentially the prophetic tradition in Israel, that is, it was not just a civil structure, it was a culture in which the voice of God was heard by prophets from time to time, and Jesus himself stands in this tradition. And so you have this strange paradox, really, of a community which functions as a state and is under divine sponsorship according to its documents, and even the kings who are appointed are themselves challenged by the prophets. The conflict between prophet and king is very critical in this matter and crucial for the development of the liberty structure that we have in the world at this day. A lot of what we go on about in the contest over alternatives and rights and so on stems from the prophetic witness in Israel. I've got to stop. Sorry to talk so long. Okay, here's one more. I've heard it argued that the origins of the God of Moses was in Midian through Jethro. In other words, Moses' encounter with God was interpreted through a tradition of Midianite mountain God interpreted through Jethro. What do we know about Midian? I don't know myself how to answer that question, but I think it's likely to be not much. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Professor. So Professor Judge is back next week. You'll see on the back page of the handout next week's talk and a couple of talks after that through to the end of the year. Next week's topic is the Ten Commandments, sidelined by Jesus. Why did Jesus insist on the law while liberating people from it? Sounds interesting. Let friends and colleagues know, and we look forward to seeing you next week.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org. Christians.